So I think there's an opportunity for us to, you know, take a fresh look at apprenticeships on a national basis and put the levers in place so that state and federal governments can collaborate in a way that drives the whole apprenticeship system forward, because at the moment the operation of it is quite fractured.
Hello and welcome to Vocational Voices, the official podcast of the National Centre for Vocational Education Research, or NCVER for short. I'm Steve Davis, and today's topic is apprenticeships. Our vocational voices today are Simon Walker, Managing Director, NCVER. Simon, hello.
Hi, Steve.
And also Ben Barden, Chief Executive Officer, the National Australian Apprenticeships Association. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Steve. How are you going?
Good. Welcome you both to the podcast. Now, the topic of apprenticeships and traineeships featured strongly in the recent federal election, and almost daily there are news stories about falling numbers of commencements and completions. But is the situation quite as dire as that? Now, I should note that this is going to be a broad discussion today, so we'll be surveying some major points. Later we'll come back, we'll drill down to some particular aspects in subsequent episodes. But to get the ball rolling, Ben, I'd like to turn to you first, because given that some of our listeners will be from various parts of the vet sector, it'd be helpful to start with the definition of some terms. So what do we mean when we say apprenticeships, and how are they different from traineeships?
Well, sure, thanks. Look, the apprenticeships, broadly speaking, are trade qualifications that take 3 or 4 years to complete, and they result in a licensed trade often. Traineeships are generally shorter qualifications, usually done in a year or sometimes 2 years, and they were created to fill gaps in the training qualifications that were available in the late 90s and to provide opportunities outside of trade qualifications for young people to join the labour force.
I just want to pick up on that, because the Mitchell Institute in Victoria University, they note that traineeships were created primarily to reduce youth unemployment. And I'm just wondering, was there some sort of accounting trick there? Are they real and are they needed? Or have they been a bureaucratic trick, Ben?
No, not at all. They are real, and they have been needed. And from about the year 2000, about 3.8% of the workforce were doing some form of apprenticeship or traineeship. Up until 2013, those traineeships included existing worker traineeships. So those were people who had already got a job, which in other countries in the world might be called graduate traineeships or graduate apprenticeships, so people who've already been in the workforce for a while. They were less targeted towards young people, but the new entrant traineeship, when you get a job for the first time, that was definitely there to try and encourage people to have qualifications in the school-to-work transition.
All right. Now, we're going to come back to them in a little bit later. But Simon, before we get too far into this, I've seen lots of figures floating around about commencements and completions, some saying dropping approximately 5% in the last year, whereas participation rates dropping 45% since 2012. There's nuance in those numbers, isn't there? How would you break them down from an NCVER research perspective and the reports you see?
Well, I might pick it up where Ben described when traineeships were first introduced in the late 90s. And by the way, there were forerunners to traineeships prior to that. But where they really took off was in around 1998. And the distinction between apprenticeships and traineeships is key. But also Ben's other point, that there's a difference between a new entrant, which I think most people would typically understand an apprenticeship or a traineeship to be, and someone who's already in the workforce. Now, at that point, there was around about 100,000 apprentices and trainees commencing in any given year. But a couple of very significant policy decisions were made at the time. So the Australian government runs employer incentives to encourage employers to take up apprentices and trainees. And in 1998, they introduced or expanded the apprenticeship incentive scheme and traineeship incentive scheme to include these people called existing workers, and at the same time also allowed part-time apprenticeships. Now, that had a dramatic effect on the demand for apprentices and trainees overall, and that grew to a peak in 2012 of about 377,000 commencing apprentices and trainees in that year. Now, I'll say today and right now, the change in demand for apprenticeships is relatively minor compared to the change in demand for traineeships. So apprenticeships are a bit more resilient. They are less subject to some of those policy changes and more associated with just economic demand and labour demand. Whereas the traineeships had a significant correlation with the changes to policy. In 2012, at the peak, the changes to the Australian government's apprenticeship scheme, which reduced incentives for existing workers to almost nothing, and also part-time, and that was where the big change downwards in the number of commencements from 2012 onwards occurred. So now you have a situation where we're running at almost half that for this current last couple of years.
For apprenticeships?
For apprenticeships and traineeships in total. The majority of that decline was in existing worker traineeships because of the change to incentives. They withdrew incentives for existing worker trainees.
Whenever I hear about apprenticeships declining, I do get nervous because there must be ramifications or consequences for just normal lay people. Mustn't there, if there are less people coming through? Or is that, again, a nuance, if it's new starts versus people already in the workforce?
Well, now you're getting into another nuance, and that is, and Ben did allude to this, if you want to become a tradesperson, typically the only way you can do that is through an apprenticeship. So you have to do a contract for training, find an employer, and in most jurisdictions, and it's states and territories that regulate apprenticeships and traineeships, you will not be able to become a plumber or a carpenter unless you do an apprenticeship. With the traineeships, you can do it either through a traineeship, right, or you could just go to a TAFE or a private training provider and get that qualification that way. So there is a difference.
Ben, what is life like for an apprentice these days?
Well, you know, there are a spectrum of experiences, I suspect, from young people who are having a really excellent time studying the trade that they've always wanted to do, that perhaps they've had friends or family do and that they understand really well what's involved, through to people who didn't really know what they want to do and are trying something out and maybe it's not going quite so well. So in the operation, you know, we've got 160,000 young people primarily commencing training each year. You're going to have a whole spectrum of different experiences. But the fundamentals remain pretty much the same. If you're doing a traditional trade apprenticeship, you'd expect to go and work for your employer for 4 days a week, typically, attend a training provider 1 day a week. You are generally earning about 65 to 70% of the minimum wage in your first year doing an apprenticeship. And some of that is offset by the fact that you're actually only working 4 days a week. You're studying, formal study, 1 day a week equivalent. So that kind of experience hasn't changed much over the years. What has changed is who your training provider might be. In the past, it would have been a TAFE, a public training provider. More and more, the training is provided through a contestable training market. And so you may have a choice of the training provider, and in some instances, the training provider may come to your workplace and help you formalise some of the skills you're developing on the job.
If that's the case, which does sound like a system that seems to be working, why am I seeing some reports about the completion rates dropping? What's behind, if that is in fact the case, what are we hearing about why apprentices aren't all going through and finishing their apprenticeships? I know you mentioned some are just trying something out, but is there anything else systemic at play?
Yeah, well, that's you raise a big area of discussion, and again, it's a nuanced discussion because first and foremost, you have to determine what you're looking at when you're looking at non-completion. Sometimes it's an apprentice who moves from one employer to another, And so their contractor training may change, but individually they may then rejoin with another employer and finish that qualification later. And when you have a look at a lot of the trades and the individual completion rates, they're up around 60%, with a couple of notable exceptions. There are very poor completion rates in hospitality, particularly those food trades where people are required to do split shifts or work late into the night, and in hairdressing. Hairdressing is a very low completion area. So there are some trades where you're getting completion levels which are reasonably good. If you think about, for example, an employer who had 10% staff turnover each year, you'd think that they were probably a pretty good employer. Well, if you're doing a four-year trade, you know, there's four lots of 10% opportunities to think that you might want to go and do something different. So by comparison to the historical past, where there was an indenture arrangement that made it very difficult for either party to get out of an apprenticeship, now that there's been sort of labour mobility and it's much easier for either the employer to say they don't have enough work or for the apprentice to want to go and do something different, I think 60% completion rate, individual completion rates, is probably okay. Typically, when it doesn't work out, it's usually an issue with the employment relationship. Something's gone wrong with the relationship with the boss or colleagues, or it isn't exactly what they expect. So rarely is it associated with the quality of training. Much, you know, this is primarily an employment pathway where you learn on the job. So usually if it doesn't work out, it's some employment-related issue.
Picking up again on what Ben just said, there is a bit of nuance here, and I will explain the data a bit. So there is a bit of a lag between the starting and finishing of an apprenticeship and the amount of people who might be in training at one time. And if we go back to some of the demand drivers for both apprenticeships and traineeships, particularly apprenticeships, it is very much about the economic conditions. And we've got to be clear here, an apprenticeship and a traineeship is just a form of employment. So, and despite the contract of training having more binding arrangements that makes it a bit more difficult to separate the employer and the employee, if during a period of economic downturn conditions deteriorate, then you are more likely to see separation between the employer and the apprentice or the trainee anyway. And I think we're seeing that effect now over the last few years. The other issue Ben raised was around the difference between a contract and an individual. We are moving from a reporting point of view more towards representing the individual's outcome, because people do change contracts and employers throughout their apprenticeship and traineeship, some in some areas more than others. And we have data that can demonstrate that. But I would suggest it's primarily just a general employment condition, not necessarily a systemic issue with the nature of apprentices and trainees.
Something that's piqued my curiosity with the two areas where we have the higher drop in completion, being hospitality and hairdressing, it occurs to me that they're the two areas where you could set up your own hairdressing salon from home and maybe not need to or not be asked to prove that you've got your ticket. Is that perhaps an area of...
Yeah, we've got to be careful to distinguish between what we call the licensed trades in particular. So Right. They vary a little bit across jurisdictions, but if there's two that are consistent across every jurisdiction, and that's plumbing and electrical. So Okay. The only way you can operate as an electrician is if you're a licensed electrician. Being a chef or working in the hospitality trade or the hairdressing trade doesn't require you to have that so-called trade certificate. So there is a difference between the two. It is interesting to observe the recent change in commencements in particular for hairdressing, because it doesn't seem to correlate with the demand for employment. We don't know the answer to that. And we do need to be a bit more research into that, because that is operating against the sort of normal demand drivers you might expect.
Yeah, I saw that too, Simon. You know, when you have a look at it, in 2014, there were 8,700 apprentices doing a hairdressing qualification. And then by 2018, it's down to, by about 1,200, I think, to 7,500. But at the same time, the the workforce has actually increased by 1% by about 1,000 people. So, you would expect that the numbers of people studying hairdressing as an apprentice would stay stable in that kind of stable employment pattern.
Yeah, and of course,
but maybe there are other related issues about the way in which apprentices are trained, because there seem to be two channels. So that you know, with any of these trades, it's worth scratching down, digging down a bit deeper to see what else is going on other than just the labour demand.
If I flip our point of context here to the actual substance of what is in the teaching framework for an apprenticeship or a traineeship, are we as a whole keeping pace with what is being demanded and in what is useful for industry, do we think? Who wants to start on that one first?
Well, I can probably give you a bit of background, and this relates as much as anything to my previous roles in government and seeing a number of national reviews and a number of state-based reviews of the apprenticeship and traineeship system. What is common, and by the way, South Australia has just released their review of their apprenticeship and traineeship system. There are some very common themes that go to the heart of exactly the question you're asking. So the main thing, as I say, is economic conditions that generally drives demand for employment, and of course employment and apprenticeships are one and the same thing. The other one is the cost of training for employers, and that's in fact why there is an apprenticeship incentive scheme in place to assist at defraying some of the costs, particularly in the early years of their apprenticeship where they're not very productive and there's more training and less outputs, if you like. Flexibility, and that I think is going to the heart of your question, is a constant refrain. So the more traditional model of having to release an apprenticeship or apprentice, for one day a week or potentially for blocks of 2 weeks of training if they're in a regional area, is something that I think employers are finding harder and harder to manage. And so Ben mentioned on-the-job training. That's one possible way of doing it. So rather than having to release them, the trainer comes to them. That's a cost issue for the training organisation, yes, because you're now dealing with individuals. So there is a sort of a trend and an inhibition that goes with the flexibility of the model, which I think is more manifest now than it was perhaps 20 or 30 years ago.
Ben?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But in addition, I'd say that one of the key things that changed, there are multiple things that changed, but from an employer's perspective, a couple of the key things were that there was no change to the incentive level since 1998 for the core incentive to take somebody on. But the costs had risen significantly, so there were reasonable pay rises for modern awards a few years ago, and we saw a dip immediately after that. And then over the last 4 or 5 years, both state and federal governments have reduced their overall funding to the VET system, which flows through to training providers. And so training providers have been required to gather more of the funds from employers. And so in some instances, the upfront costs of to an employer of paying for the enrollment fee were greater than the incentives that they could get in that first period. So it was more costly wages and a greater cost of actually enrolling a student. There used to be sort of nominal enrollment fees of a few hundred dollars, but in recent years they've gone up to as high as $3,000 or $4,000 that an employer has to pay.
If I'm not wrong, you're arguing that employer incentives are not necessarily the best mechanisms to use to boost numbers, participation numbers. Is that right? And if so, what would be a better approach if, in fact, increasing the pool of apprentices and trainees is important?
I support them in the Australian context. I mean, I've looked at different systems around the world, and there are some systems that operate without employer incentives. But the way that we've built ours makes the particularly small businesses very alert to small changes. So when we had the global financial crisis, for a period the incentives were doubled because there was concern of looming skill shortages if employers just stopped employing young people. And so That worked. I mean, it really worked. It kept enrollment. It kept enrollment numbers up during the global financial crisis, when other sectors of the economy weren't putting workers on. So that it works in the Australian context, and certainly some of the incentive programs that the federal government introduced last year were extremely popular. They got snapped up very, very quickly. And there are a range in the pipeline that are welcome too. In Germany, you may not need them because you've got a kind of long cultural history of employers seeing it as their obligation. But over here, it's more transactional.
The structural changes to the labour market that have occurred over the last, well, arguably 50 years. So you now have a situation where you've got a significant rise in part-time employment. And there's a lot of reasons for that and some complexities associated with that as well. Not the least that people are staying in education longer. So if you consider that, or as I think most people do, you conceive of an apprentice or a trainee being a young person entering employment for the first time. Well, they're actually going into universities in a way that's never happened before. They have a lot of other options. And because the jobs themselves, the growth in jobs have been part-time arrangements don't lend themselves to apprentices and traineeships the way a full-time employment does. And that is having an impact as well.
Whilst there are some structural changes that explain some of the reduced numbers, there are some areas of the economy that are growing really quickly. Health and welfare support workers grew by 28% over the last 5 years. Carers and aides grew by 24%. And yet, in both of those areas, traineeship numbers are falling quite significantly, by roughly 3,000 people a year. And so there are a range of other factors at play. Some of them are licensing related, and some of them are, if you're becoming an aged care worker, for example, doing a traineeship to become an aged care worker, a lot of employers are preferring to have that person trained up front, not in a traineeship model of on-the-job learning, but maybe they do a Cert 3 qualification in 6 months with a training provider before they come into that workforce. So I think it's worth considering what are the other pathways into some of these roles, and would it be better to have traineeships rather than upfront training? And I'd argue in most instances it would.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Ben. And if you look at the growth in the social services and allied health sector, they are dominated by not-for-profits in many ways, and some of them are relatively small scale, not all of them, mind you. Again, a fairly high level of part-time workforce as well. So they find the construct, that they find it difficult to manage efficiently a traineeship type model, and would prefer to have some pre-trained and then pretty much do it on the job, but without the contractor training arrangement. So when we're looking at overall numbers, the effect of that large growth in employment in those sectors does not appear proportionally in the traineeship and apprenticeship demand area. So that's a really good point Ben makes.
I also wonder, Ben mentioned before that in the global financial crisis, the government just upped the incentives and we saw a sugar hit of an increase of take-up. The federal treasurer just recently has announced 80,000 new apprenticeships in industries where there are shortages. Are we ever really going to break that need for needing the government to put the foot on the pedal?
What I look at is what historically have we required as a percentage of the workforce to be in apprenticeships and traineeships to both provide the level of skills that the economy needs, the mix of skills it needs, and to provide pathways, school to work transition pathways for young people primarily. And it's about 3.8%. I think I mentioned that before. Well, over the last few years, since 2013, that's gone from 3.8% of the workforce down to just about 2% of the workforce now. So the workforce is growing strongly. There's been a reduction, there's been the removal of the existing worker traineeships, and there's been a reduction in traineeship levels overall. So in terms of does it make sense to invest in this area, I'd argue yes, because, you know, when you have a look at the level that we've required for much of this century so far, it's around 3.8%. And when you compare us to our near neighbours in New Zealand, for example, they've got 5.5% of their workforce doing apprenticeships and traineeships in similar but not identical labour market conditions. So, Scotland's got 13%. So at the moment, we've got a bit of a crisis with very low levels of the overall workforce being trained in under contracts of training with the on-the-job learning formalised. And so it is worth investing to try and get those levels back up.
And I've got a nephew who just got accepted into an apprenticeship in the refrigeration air conditioning field. So happiness for our family. Can we look out more broadly? Are there signs of hope? Are there some interesting and positive things out there that you're seeing, Ben, in particular?
Well, I think the 80,000 places where incentives are doubled and there is 2,000 going to the apprentice in addition will be very welcome. You mentioned before, a sugar hit component. So that would be 20,000 a year out of 160,000 commencements, roughly. So you'll have 20,000 people who are very positive about it, both their employers and the apprentices themselves. And then, you know, there'll be quite a few other employers and apprentices saying, well, what about us? I think it'll be interesting to see whether that results in net additional places and what else can be done to drive the growth of primarily small businesses returning to the apprenticeship system to be able to provide opportunities. And certainly, in the new contract for the apprenticeship support network, there are a range of other levers that are being envisaged there to try and encourage first-time employers of apprentices to come into the system and become part of it. Many of those trade businesses, you know, have come through the system, so they understand it. It's just trying to encourage them to, now that they run their business, to participate in providing those opportunities. So,
for actors in the vocational education training sector, Simon, firstly, are there some obvious areas where you think we should be applying some focus or thinking about reacting to trends that we're starting to spot?
Well, I think, and this is a bit of a personal observation, you know, with a young son, but also what I know of other people and their young families are doing, you have got this massive decline over time in full-time employment for young people. Now, I think that will have some major implications for society. I think one of the best things you can do when you're young, and I know what it was like for me, was just getting into the workforce. And this is a good model. I mean, no one disputes, despite all the issues that surround apprenticeships and traineeships, that the model of integrating employment, and it's effectively full-time employment in the main, with formal learning is a terrific way to develop the skills and the human capital. So I'd just like to think if people could just consider that for the moment when government's doing its policy, when employers are considering what they need for their workforce. And employers are the first people that will say, I can't get the skills. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a shared responsibility. And so between governments and employers, we have a model that could well do with some fine tuning, and this flexibility issue may well be one of those issues. But overall, it's sort of perverse that we have pretty much consensus around a model that everyone agrees is a great way to develop skills and human capital, but we're somehow not getting it together.
Mm-hmm. Ben, from your perspective, National Australian Apprenticeships Association?
I kind of imagine myself, you know, imagine if I was still in the UK and looking into the Australian system, there'd be a few things that I would expect to see. I'd probably expect to see a national apprenticeship policy with bipartisan support like they have in Germany. I'd probably expect to see some secure funding arrangements for public providers and the contestable training market so that priorities could change and evolve over time and providers would be able to respond to that. I probably expect to see a funding envelope that would increase over time for the vocational system to be able to keep pace with rising costs. I probably expect to see a national campaign. The New Zealanders are excellent at this. That foregrounds the benefits for young people taking vocational pathways. And I'd probably expect to see a regulatory environment that supported the quality of the system and didn't sort of drive a kind of compliance-based pedagogy, for want of a better approach. And unfortunately, when we look into our system, we've got none of those things. And so I think there's an opportunity for us to, take a fresh look at apprenticeships on a national basis and put the levers in place so that state and federal governments can collaborate in a way that drives the whole apprenticeship system forward. Because at the moment, the operation of it is quite fractured. And so there's plenty of opportunity for us to do better and return our system to the sort of pinnacle of global apprenticeship training systems that it had the reputation for probably 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, I think that's an optimistic note. And one that's worth pondering to finish on, especially because, as we promised, we've done a broad survey of the scenario at the moment. We'll come back with some more detailed and drilled down episodes in the future. Ben Barden and Simon Walker, thank you both.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Vocational Voices is produced by NCVER on behalf of the Australian Government and state and territory governments, with funding provided through the Australian Government Department of Employment, Skills, Small and Family Business. For more information, please visit ncver.edu.au.